welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, a podcast that is absolutely committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. And today I have a guest who is a hero of mine. I've known him for a long time. I've done a lot of podcasts with him. And this podcast is on, well, let me just introduce it quickly. It's the 20th anniversary edition of The Privileged Planet. We've talked about The Privileged Planet on this podcast before, but this is a very important update. And of course, Jay answers the question as to whether or not Earth is a privileged planet. You know, there are some scientists who are speculating that the Earth is merely an insignificant speck of soil that is aimlessly adrift in a meaningless universe. But evidence, and you'll hear that evidence today, refutes the principle of mediocrity. And instead, it demonstrates that our Earth, well, it's singularly privileged. And it's a planet that is designed for discovery. And Jay gives a lot of reasons for that. And I'll formally introduce him in just a moment. I'll even mention his last name. But the first of those reasons is that there are unique conditions that are necessary to support intelligent life, and they turn out to provide the best overall conditions for scientific discovery. A second reason, and I put this in a memorable format in one of my books, but the second reason is that we live in the best overall age of the universe. Think about that, the best overall age of the universe to do cosmology. In our time, the cosmic background radiation that is left over from the Big Bang is readily observable. But here's the key. It won't always be like that. And that radiation confirms that the universe is not eternal, but it began in the finite past. And let me give you one more reason. I like to do things in threes. From habitability to discoverability, and these are two key words in this book. From habitability to discoverability, Earth's status in the universe is surely, absolutely, beyond a doubt, one of privilege. And if you were to reduce that to an accident of cosmic evolution, you would be short-sighted. But if you recognize it as privileged, well, that's sublime. And that's precisely why this book is titled The Privileged Planet. And it is one of my favorite books. And this is the 20th anniversary edition. And it has many additions to it that are important. So this is a book that you can get on the web at equip.org. You can write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. It's for those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. Well, let me give you Jay's last name. If you followed the podcast, you already know what his last name is. It's Richards, J.W. Richards. And he is director of the DeVos Center for Life, Religion, and Family at the Heritage Foundation. He's a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, and he's the executive editor of The Stream. Now, Jay is incredibly credentialed. If I went over all of his credentials, it would take a while. But he is a PhD in philosophy and theology from Princeton Theological Seminary, among other things. I'm not going to go through the other things. He's contributed to many articles in the Christian Research Journal, and he's the author of 14 incredible books. Maybe it's more by now. Maybe it's 15. I don't know. 14 or 15 incredible books, including the New York Times bestsellers, Infiltrated and Indivisible, and a book titled Money, Greed, and God, which was one of my favorites. It also won a 2010 Templeton Enterprise Award. He wrote a book that I followed religiously for a long period of time, but I don't anymore. I need to get back to. When I'm looking at Jay, I'm thinking I need to get back to this book. It's titled Eat, Fast and Feast, and then a book that is incredibly relevant to this age. It's titled The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. I mean, that's an incredible book, and I want to ask Jay a question about that in just a moment. But the book that we're talking about today is The Privileged Planet, and we're going to focus on that remarkable work. It's just come out not long ago in the updated, revised format. And so, Jay, as always, I love having you on the podcast, and you are one of my heroes. You're someone that not only does incredible writing and speaking, but you do the research that's necessary to be able to demonstrate that what you're talking about is not your own vivid predilections, but it is faith founded on a refutable fact. So thanks for being on the podcast again.
Oh, thank you, Hank. It's so great to be with you. So fun. I mean, we probably talked about the book 20 years ago, which is kind of scary to think. But, you know, Guillermo Gonzalez and I, when we were writing it, we actually realized, okay, the book's coming out in 2004. There's going to be a total solar eclipse in the U.S. in 2024. So maybe we'll do a 20th year anniversary edition and we'll update it. But of course, that's something you tell yourself. And then that's actually what happened. And one of the most important things that I learned in the process was that you're a lot better writer 20 years older. It's because when you read it, it's like, gosh, I've spent 20 years writing and trying to translate stuff for broader and broader audiences. And so what we thought would just be an update and some references ended up really being a rewrite, not to change the argument, but just to hopefully make it more accessible.
And also to update it based on...
Absolutely.
Yeah. Just an incredible piece of work. Before we get into The Privileged Planet, I did want to ask you a quick question on the human advantage. We're going to be in Athens in a month's time. And in this book, you talk about the future of American work in an age of smart machines. A lot of people think that it is possible for machines to replace human beings. You make the argument in that book that that will never happen. Why?
Right. Because we're not machines. That's the simple answer. And so for something to entirely replace us, they would have to be everything that we are. Now, you might say, well, okay, but the things we do that are machine-like, that has everything to do with our work. And so therefore, the meaningful work that we do will ultimately be replaced by machines. And so part of this is a metaphysical claim, right? But part of it is a kind of empirical claim. And so when I wrote the book, it came out in 2018, I wanted to give the other side as much credit as possible. And so in other words, I basically said, okay, let's assume that anything that can be automated using a combination of AI and robotics will be automated. Moreover, let's assume that that's going to happen in our lifetimes. What does that mean? And the book's really, though there's a lot of philosophy in it, it's really designed to say, okay, if that happens, here's what you need to do to prepare. And my argument is that, in fact, machines will do a lot of stuff that humans are doing right now, but there's a lot of other stuff that they won't do. And as long as we pivot to the things that are uniquely human, we will be able to do profound things, important things that are meaningful, that are work. It's just that it will look different than what it looks like now, just as the way we farm now looks different than the way it looked 100 or 200 or 500 years ago, or the way we write. If technology permanently replaced people, that is, it permanently created massive unemployment, all of human history would be this really depressing story of more and more people finding that they don't have anything to do. But that's not what happens at all. At different technological stages, what that does is maybe something that we need a lot of labor for at an earlier period, we're able to automate or develop machines so that, you know, it only takes five people to do what it took 5,000 people to do at a previous era. That doesn't mean there's nothing left to do. It means that, you know, we're creatures made in the image of the creative God. We find new and important and hopefully dignifying things to do that presuppose all the technology that sort of went before us. And so there's a bit of metaphysics in this. What are humans? Can we be reduced to machines? There's a good bit of economics. And then there's also some predictions about what I thought was and was not going to happen. And I thought, for instance, that automated long-haul trucks, that would be easier to pull off than, say, a housekeeper that's entirely robotic, because that involves complex movement through space. I'd say the biggest surprise is probably how powerful these chatbots, so-called large language models, are, how good they are. But it doesn't prove that we're machines. It doesn't mean these things are going to become conscious. It just means that we're able to develop systems that can call and sort and run probabilities on all the intelligent choices that we make. And so everything you see in Claude or in ChatGPT-4 is it the self? It's itself the result of human intelligence, and the data it's trained on is all information that's the result of human intelligence. And so I just think that's the kind of fundamental reality. And the nice thing is, there's this metaphysical claim the transhumanists make that machines will surpass us. The best we can do is upload ourselves to the machines. They give specific dates. And so I said, okay, great. Let's make some empirical claims and see who's right and who's wrong about this stuff.
Yeah, so what about the panpsychism, the idea that somehow or other there's a materialistic way in which you can explain consciousness?
Yeah, it seems so strange to me because, of course, as you said, panpsychism, in some ways, that would be the philosophically consistent way that transhumanists could sort of do this, that every bit of matter, sort of has a little consciousness in it. And when you combine it into larger and larger structures, like a human, right, we're made up of all sorts of different cells, that then there's kind of this emergent consciousness for matter. That's an interesting argument. I don't think it really works because we all pretty much, we recognize that there's just the constituents of matter are not themselves agents in the ways that humans or even say animals are. But what's interesting is that almost all the transhumanists don't go that route. They're not panpsychists, they're not pantheists, they're materialists. And so you get someone like Ray Kurzweil, who in a sense really believes that we're machines. And so he thinks, look, you get computers working fast enough and sophisticated enough, they really can become everything we are. And then you say, okay, well, so what are you talking about? What about our consciousness? What about our agency? What about the fact that we're persons? And he will either say, well, that's something that can be uploaded, by which he ends up meaning a brain pattern, or he says, well, who's to say that we're conscious? Maybe we're just, that's an illusion or something, which to me is, okay, you're making an argument that our consciousness and agency is an illusion. That's a pretty good argument that whatever you're thinking is seriously wrong, right? If that's your conclusion, I doubt your premise. But that's the kind of dilemma. If you're a committed materialist, you're sort of stuck because it's not like you can say, well, I believe that humans are a unique hybrid of body and soul, and the soul can somehow be detached from the body and uploaded. They never appeal to that. So they're never going to deal to a Christian anthropology. They never really even appealed to panpsychism. They're just materialists and they're inconsistent. And I think the reason they're inconsistent is because all of us, no matter what our kind of metaphysical views, if in fact human beings are this unique, we're unique creatures that are the dust of the earth and the breath of God, we are fully human and are fully material, fully spiritual at the same time. If your anthropology doesn't get that right, then you're going to go off the rails somewhere, but you're never ultimately going to be able to deny it. So even the materialist who really doesn't have a basis for believing he has freedom or agency or consciousness nevertheless presupposes it when he's not thinking about it. And so he ends up being inconsistent. And so materialists almost always end up kind of metaphysically schizophrenic, which is what I think you have. You certainly have this in transhumanism. You have it in gender ideology, where the person is treated as a kind of disembodied gender soul that might get stuck in the wrong body. All these attempts to kind of account for humanity, but without getting the Christian and the biblical understanding of the richness of what the human person is. If you don't get that, you still have to be confronted by it because you are yourself a human person in all of its fullness. But your metaphysic doesn't really and can't really account for it.
Yeah, I want to get right to the privileged planet. You know, we did do the first broadcast on this back in 2004, as you mentioned. I had hair back then. You still have hair 20 years later. But what is the privileged planet hypothesis?
You summarized it. It's basically, here's the claim, is that those rare places in the universe where life can exist, that is the most habitable places in the universe, are also the best places overall for doing science, for scientific discovery. So observers, complex observers like ourselves, find themselves in the best places overall for observing. And so this is, multiple parts of this argument are required. The first is this whole idea of habitability, that not just any old place is going to be good for life. Almost everything we learn, and everything, frankly, we've learned since in the last 20 years, I think shows that you got to get a lot of stuff at the local level, that is the kind of level of the planetary system, just right in order to have a planet that can even host life. We're not even talking about life itself. We're just talking about a planet in which life can exist and persist. And so that's interesting on its own. But you could ask this other question. Okay, if you needed to do science, you needed to discover whether the universe had a beginning. That's got to be the biggest question. How old the universe is, how it works, what the stars are, what the world is made of, what fundamental principles govern the movements of matter. All these kinds of questions you need to ask, if you're going to do science. And then you say, okay, and you could pick only one place to be. Where would that be? And you run the analysis, and what you discover is the best place to be is the one place where life can exist. That's an astonishing discovery. It's one thing to say that habitable planets are very rare in the universe. It's another thing to say that there's this pervasive pattern in which the things you need to build a habitable planet also set that planet up for doing science. And science in that place can be done a lot better than the less habitable places. And it's that coincidence, that combination of the needs for life and the needs for scientific discovery together, that we think that forms a strong design argument. It's like, okay, look, if the universe is designed for discovery, that's exactly what you would expect. If you're a materialist that thinks everything is the result of blind chance and necessity, this is just, there's really no explanation for it. It's just a weird brute fact that you can't account for. So yeah, maybe this isn't a deductive proof for God's existence, but it's a pretty darn strong argument for design of the universe by an intelligence that transcends it.
So explain what your argument is not, because a lot of critics say that you're making the claim that Earth is unique and therefore it is designed. That's not really your argument, is it?
Not at all. And in fact, whether Earth or Earth-like planets are common or rare in the universe, is metaphysically ambiguous. I mean, put it this way, if there's a transcendent God, as we believe, God could create the universe in a lot of ways. He could have made it just our solar system with life on Earth. He could have made it where there's habitable planets everywhere. All those things are sort of possible for God. And so it's not like theism entails either that life be rare or life be common. And so just because you discover that, okay, we've got a really big universe, maybe 10 to the 22 observable stars in the universe, the observable universe, that's a big place, a lot of potential planets around those stars. It could be, for instance, if you're a materialist, you might say, okay, well, maybe it's just really, really hard to get the conditions for life, but in a universe that's large enough, one will happen to have the conditions that life needs. Like it's like a vast cosmic lottery. And in that one place, life will, presumably evolve or appear. And that's kind of the materialist assumption. And so a materialist could be fine with life being rare in the universe, even though most materialists, for some reason, go the other way. They think, well, whatever happened here must have happened countless times elsewhere because there's nothing special about the Earth. That's the general kind of drift in the debate. Nevertheless, Guillermo Gonzalez and I say, look, really kind of metaphysically, it could go either way. And so we want to know empirically whether that's true or not. And so we just think that would be a bad argument to say, okay, well, gosh, it's Earth-like planets or habitable planets are really rare in the universe, therefore God had to do it, because that's just not a great argument. I mean, there's no way else to put it. But that is what people very often thought the argument was going to be, because it takes a bit of time to explain that, no, we're building an argument on this remarkable coincidence of the needs for life and the needs for scientific discovery. We needed the rarity in order to see the pattern, that in fact, compared to most of the other places and the other planets where that we actually know exist, there's just a few that actually make only one that we know of so far that can possibly host life. And so it's very interesting to discover that those very rare places are also the best places for doing science.
Yeah, so your argument is about the fact that Earth is habitable and it's also a perfect place for scientific discovery.
That's right. Yeah. Or perfect in the sense that it's the best
Ideal.
optimized sort of condition. Yeah. If you think of these things, there's lots of trade-offs, of course, that have to be made. So the best overall place, like if you, in other words, if you can only pick one place, And you'd need to know things, say, about the recent past. You'd need to know things about the distant past. You need to know some stuff about physics, whether the universe had a beginning, all these kinds of things. It turns out there's complicated trade-offs because there's kind of competing conditions. So, for instance, if all you wanted to do is discover the background radiation, okay, well, the best place to detect that would be between galaxies, probably in intergalactic space. But you would optimize your situation to discover that one thing. That would be a terrible place to discover the laws of gravity or what happened in the recent past, or to do chemistry. And so what you want is to optimize for all these kinds of competing conditions. And when you get that, then that's the argument that in fact what you get is an Earth-like planet. You get the planet that we have. We can't prove that there aren't other Earth-like planets in the universe. We really don't have enough evidence one way or the other, but we can make a prediction that if we're right, if there are other Earth-like planets in the universe, they will be very, very, very much like the Earth. They will have moons and suns very much like ours. They'll have perfect solar eclipses like we enjoy. And so that's actually a prediction of our argument. But we don't predict you'll never find an Earth-like planet. We say if you find one, it will be very much like the Earth.
So it'd be an Earth twin.
Yeah, it'd be an Earth twin. In fact, Guillermo says if we ever detect a radio transmission, for instance, from some other intelligent civilization, the first thing we should do is send them digital copies of our pictures, of our best solar eclipse pictures, and ask them to send us some of theirs.
I want to quote your favorite astrophysicist, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is an evangelist for our insignificance. You believe in our significance, he believes in our insignificance. And he actually says this, and you quote this in the book, "Every advance in our knowledge of the cosmos has revealed that we live on a cosmic speck of dust orbiting a mediocre star in the far suburbs of a common sort of galaxy, a common sort of galaxy, among 100 billion galaxies in the universe. The news of our cosmic unimportance triggers impressive defense mechanisms in the human psyche." So he's basically talking about the Copernican principle, the principle of mediocrity.
That's right. Yeah. And so Neil deGrasse Tyson is the kind of our generation's current incarnation of Carl Sagan, whom we, of course, also quote in the book. And Carl Sagan, who's since deceased, was the science popularizer that said this. In fact, he wrote a book called Pale Blue Dot, in which he said, "We don't hold a privileged position in the universe." deGrasse Tyson says the same thing. Of course, notice the kind of evaluative judgments here. So he says that we're in some unassuming suburb in the galaxy. Well, okay, so the obvious question is, where would you want to be in the galaxy? Okay, so we're in a large spiral galaxy, which we call the Milky Way. So where would be the best spot to be? And you say, okay, best for what? Well, how about best for life? That's really the interesting thing, right? We know that. Well, the last place you'd want to be is the center of the galaxy. It probably has a giant black hole. There's all this X-ray and gamma radiation. You've got stars popping off and getting sucked in. It's the most hostile place in the galaxy. If you're in the outer part of the solar system, it's mostly hydrogen and helium. There's not even enough to sort of heavy materials to build Earth-like planets. If you're inside a spiral arm, you're gonna have there's it's, that's also much riskier because of star formation. Where you'd want to be, as it turns out, when you study all the conditions for what you need in a galaxy, so the so-called galactic habitable zone is midway out between the center and the edge of the galaxy, between spiral arms and rotating at about the same speed as the spiral arms. Guess where we are? We're exactly there. We're right in the sweet spot of the galactic habitable zone. And so for the thing you would be interested in, we're in prime location. It's only by sort of sleight of hand, implying that, well, we're not in the center of the galaxy or something, that anyone could be tricked by that. What does it mean for our star to be ordinary? First of all, it's not true. Most of the stars of the galaxy are these red M dwarf stars. Our star is quite stable. It's a single star, so it's not a binary or triplet system. Again, for life, this is exactly what you'd want. And so you just add up. I mean, we could go through a list of about 30 of these things, and the stuff that he considers insignificant clearly are not. It's only by he's sort of assuming the ignorance of his audience as to the details so that they'll just kind of get the ambiance that, well, yeah, it is a big universe and We don't, you know, it doesn't look like an interesting place to be in the galaxy. And so it's really a kind of surface level analysis, assuming that people are just sort of stupefied by the size of the universe or something like that. But again, notice that the folks that say, well, we're insignificant because we're small relative to the universe, they never do the opposite. They never say, well, we're on the other hand, we're really significant compared to the size of elementary particles, quarks, right? I mean, you could argue that. But of course, physical size and significance are just two different things. We're not going to answer the question one way or the other with that. And the details are going to be subtler. And if the, you know, that's what I actually think. If the universe is created by God, it is a book meant to be read. Expect it to be subtle so that people that are open to the evidence, open to being able to read it and understand its meaning, can detect that. But if you want these kind of superficial stories like Neil deGrasse Tyson tells, well, God gives you the freedom to be able to believe those, but it really is a superficial treatment.
Yeah, and that really gets to a point that I want to drive home, if you would. People like Tyson, they make these dogmatic assertions, not defensible arguments. And I think today people no longer think, they no longer ponder, they no longer examine. We're hit by so much information overload, that we can't process it. And I'm wondering, even as the father of many children, how do you inoculate people that really don't have an opportunity to think through these things as you have? I mean, obviously, this is one of the reasons you wrote the book, The Privileged Planet, but not everybody will read a big book like that. In fact, many people don't read anymore. How do you inoculate people against these? I mean, even in the political realm, you hear these incredibly fabricated statements, but they're just communicated as though they're common sense fact. And people are getting the information so quickly, they can't really fact check it, if you will.
That's right. I mean, this is the irony of our moment, Hank, is that if you know how to do it, you can get access to almost any information from your house. But on the other hand, it's curated and manipulated, and most of us have lost the ability to focus. I mean, you said, so how do you inoculate your children? Well, you inoculate your children by making sure that I honestly think don't, you aren't exposed to a lot of this stuff. So they're not exposed to the kind of fast-moving technology until their brains can handle it. You help them to develop the attention span to be able to read and study and ponder great texts.
What does that mean? Does that mean, Jay, you take the smartphones out of their hands?
Yeah, it means that if they're a little kid, you do not give them access to smartphones. Absolutely. I mean, you know, maybe 15 years ago, I hadn't thought that much about this because, you know, they had just come online. But I'm really glad that, you know, smartphones were, first of all, expensive and not really available when our girls were little anyway. And so they got through that. But I've now seen what happens when really young kids are given screens way too early. And no one can accuse me of being a Luddite, but this technology is designed kind of, it's for images and short attention spans for most people. And it's quite clear that people's capacity for attention is diminishing. And this is the difficulty. Okay, so how do you inoculate people in general that are subject to that, to these bad ideas? Well, you have to reach them in different ways. You do it on podcasts, for instance, or you do it in documentary style format. And so you hope that you can point people to the source, which is the big book with, you know, 100 pages of references. But I always try to remind myself that most people are going to read the headline and hear the summary. And so I got to figure out how to boil this down. I can tell you this is always the difficulty with this book is, first of all, it's a lot of data. It's a cumulative case argument. And also it takes a couple of steps to explain it because it was just Earth's unique and rare and therefore God designed it. That'd be really simple, but it's a little more complicated than that. But I also think it's much more satisfying once you get what's going on. And that's the difficulty. So first, optimize how you're going to inoculate your kids by giving them the capacity for attention. But then, just as God condescends to us and our capacities, we have to do that for our fellow human beings, so that we communicate at kind of different levels and in different paces and boil this stuff down in different ways.
You use the word optimized. This is a word you use in your book when you talk about constrained optimization. I think that's a really interesting subject.
It is. And so this is that we actually get the term from engineering. And every engineer knows this, that you don't optimize anything you're building for everything. So we use the example of a laptop, for instance. And so if you said, okay, what's the best laptop? You said, well, Let's see, it would be the laptop with the biggest screen. Oh, really? Okay, so like how big? 10 feet square feet? Well, of course not, because then it's not portable, right? And so you say, well, okay, the one with the fastest processor available. Really? That's going to cost several million dollars. And by the way, it's going to be really unstable. Okay, now that's not going to be quite right. Yeah. How about weight? Because if you want a big processor, it's going to be heavier and hotter and use a lot more battery power. You can see where this is going, of course. The best laptop is going to be the one that best optimizes all these competing conditions into this kind of sweet spot. And that's what if you're designing a bridge, it's the same thing. You're designing it for stability over time, but you have to meet cost, you have to use the materials that are available. It's that kind of thing. And so people have to think of that. Okay, now if you're building a planet, in which you're going to have all these different chemical elements and you have sources of energy that are important from the sun, but also deadly, right? You can sort of imagine God, the great engineer, creating a material universe. They're going to be the he, even God is going to have to make these kind of logical trade-offs. And so we should, that's, but on the other hand, if the universe is designed for discovery, what we would find is that these best places that meet the conditions for life are also going to be the best places overall, in the same way that kind of the best laptop overall for scientific discovery. That is for making different kinds of discoveries that on their own require kind of a different set of conditions. And so you're trying to solve this very complex problem.
An omniscient God would never make the mistake of creating the human eye. I've heard that argument because
Yeah.
there are problems with the human eye. But this, again, goes to your point of constrained optimization.
Absolutely. And of course, this is a story that we all heard for the longest time, that the human eye is wired backwards, so there's this hole in it. And the idea is, Richard Dawkins loves these arguments that, well, God wouldn't have done anything this way, which is always interesting. Atheists know how God would have done things, but they're distilling in their argument, it's that it looks like it's poorly engineered. And in every case, you just have to kind of have to look at the details. And in that case, knowledgeable people have quit using that argument because it turns out there is a really important functional reason for it to be wired that way. And in fact, the so-called hole in our visual system is compensated for in other ways so that it doesn't actually mess up our vision. Now, of course, the world has fallen, so we can't always expect things are exactly the way God designed them originally. Nevertheless, so many of these arguments fall apart on closer inspection that I just usually treat the prior probability of these claims as pretty low, a very low chance of it being true, but you still got to look at the details.
Yeah. Let's talk about one of the things you write about in the book, and that's solar eclipses. On the one hand, they're beautiful and they're inspiring. On the other hand, as you point out, they've played a very significant role in scientific discovery.
That's right. And people wonder, that's how we open the book. It's actually the idea of eclipses is what gave us the idea for the argument. And so just to explain to people that maybe didn't see the eclipse or haven't thought about it, is that to get a perfect eclipse like we have on the Earth, you need first to be all you need a sort of platform that you're on. You need an occulting or eclipsing body like the moon. You need a light source, which is the sun. And then you need them all to line up in space in a straight line. And then if they're going to have a perfect eclipse, they need to appear the same size and shape from your vantage point, which is what we have, right? And that's something that we take for granted, but we really shouldn't. And so as it happens from the Earth, the moon is 400 times closer than the sun. It's also 400 times smaller than the sun. And so you get this very eerie match between the sun and the moon, so that we get these perfect eclipses. Where you get this kind of blackness in the sky. Guillermo and I saw it this April from Waxahachie, Texas, right in the center of the path of totality. It was about 4.5 minutes. You cannot look at the sun with the naked eye, even if there's a slight bit of the bright photosphere available. But as soon as the disk of the moon covers the sun, you can look at it directly. It's like a black pupil with an iris in the sky. It's absolutely magnificent. And so the question is, okay, well, that's neat, but what does that have to do with your argument? Well, two of the important things you need to build a habitable planet, the one big one is the distance from your host star. So you need to be where it's not too hot and not too cold, the so-called Goldilocks zone. So if you're in the Goldilocks zone, that's going to fix the size of the star in your sky, right, or sun. Another thing you need is a large, well-placed moon to stabilize the tilt of your planet's axis and to contribute to the tides. And when you get those two things that are needed for life to build two important ingredients for making your planet habitable, it sets up the conditions for perfect solar eclipses. And perfect solar eclipses, as you mentioned a minute ago, are this natural experiment that have allowed us to discover things about the universe that we would have had a very hard time discovering otherwise. Let me just give you one kind of the most intuitive example would be the test for Einstein's general theory of relativity. So Einstein, when he developed his special and general theory, a prediction of his theory, it's fairly arcane for people that don't study it, but was that there's this thing called space-time and massive objects. It's not like gravity is a force, a pulling force. What happens is that space-time gets bent by massive bodies, and then that affects the kind of movement of things around it. And so a prediction of his theory. So, well, if this is right, as opposed to, say, the Newtonian view of gravity, then what would happen is that when a kind of directional light passes near the edge of a massive body, it would appear to move from where you would expect it to be. So, for instance, if you were to look at the sun, or you look at the night sky and you map where the stars are when the sun's not there, and then you come back later when the sun is there and you look at stars that are those same stars passing right near the edge of the sun, it will look like they've moved because the light, the starlight passing near the edge of the sun will be curved, will be bent by the mass of the sun. Of course, you can't do that normally because you can't see the starlight near the edge of the sun, except during a perfect solar eclipse. And that is exactly what happened during the eclipse of 2000 or of 1919. Sir Arthur Eddington, a couple of teams tested this and confirmed Einstein's theory. And astronomers have continued to do that and to refine it since then. So really the most important theory of the 20th century that was at least the most important for understanding the universe as a whole was tested and was able to be tested because of a perfect solar eclipse. And there's a bunch of other examples, but eclipses, every astronomer knows how important eclipses have been for scientific discovery. And so it's sort of staggering to realize that, gosh, we enjoy these things, these amazing things, because of the needs for life. And when you get those, God, I think, has set this up so that we also get access to the universe that we would not have otherwise.
You know, in some sense, reading The Privileged Planet 20 years ago changed the way I look at the world. You look in the daytime at the sun.
Yes.
Well, there's the sun. Look at night at the moon. You know, sometimes a half moon, maybe it's a quarter. You look at it, so what? Sun, moon. But when you start to see the things like solar eclipses, what you just mentioned, the ratio of size between sun and moon, then all of a sudden you recognize the words of Scripture being impactful and true. The heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech, night after night they proclaim knowledge. There's no speech or language where their voice is not heard, their words go out to the ends of the earth. So you start looking at the universe differently. And I think that's one of the great advantages of this book. I mean, it intoxicates you with the beauty and the glory of God's created handiwork, things that you might never otherwise pay any attention to.
Absolutely. I mean, Hank, people, and so eclipses for the lucky people that are in the path of one during their life, of course, have been happening for thousands of years, and humans have been astonished by them the entire time. But our sort of understanding about what's required to set it up and the way in which it connects to the needs for habitability and discovery, these are all fairly recent discoveries. That's what's sort of amazing is that people have the Christians often have the impression that, well, science is overwhelmingly hostile to faith, and this is kind of the worst time to be alive for being a Christian. Well, in a sense, it's tough, but in another sense, it's probably the best time. I mean, it was only in the 20th century that we had really good empirical evidence that the universe had a beginning. Before then, we believed it on faith, and maybe there were some philosophical arguments for the impossibility of infinite regress. But to realize that, no, in fact, the best evidence from the natural world tells us the universe had a beginning in the finite past. Christians spend our time arguing about how old it is and don't notice that if it's old, if it's any age, that makes life very hard for the materialist because no longer can the material universe be the ultimate reality because it had a beginning. That's the era in which we live. And so I honestly think in some ways, God left it to this time for the created order to disclose these things about it. The psalmist from the beginning, of course, the psalmist, as you said, he said, the heavens declare the glory of God. So it's actively participating in the glory of God, but there's rich detail and more detail all the way down. It's like wheels within wheels or an encrypted message in which there's one message at one level and then you magnify it and you find another message. That's what I think is happening. And I think, look, if we're right, Guillermo and I, we found the first couple of dozen good examples of this, but we think if we're right, we'll discover a bunch of other stuff and the pattern will continue to be confirmed.
You use so many memorable phrases. One of the phrases that you use in your talks and in your writing is the fact that Earth is a data recorder.
Yes. Yes. And this is another thing that that's our chapter two. And so we all know that you can count the age of a tree by reading tree rings as a kind of rough estimate, right? And so it's just a kind of an accretion of development with a tree ringing by, you know, cutting at the trunk of a tree. A few people know that there are ice cores. So for instance, there's Lake Vostok in Antarctica and sites in Greenland in which you can kind of do the same thing vertically. You can just drill a core and there are these layers of ice that get more and more compressed. And based upon the isotope ratios that correspond to the sunspot cycles, you can actually date those in these kind of 11-year increments. And then based upon the materials that are in those layers and isotope ratios, you can actually figure out what's happening in the distant past in terms of temperature, what's happening in terms of the climate, all sorts of things that you can reconstruct it much sort of farther back than you could with tree rings. There are cores on lake sediments and ocean sediments. There, you can do the same thing with stalactites and stalagmites. These are these layering processes that only exist. First of all, they're all either based upon the hydrological cycle or basic biological processes needed for life. And yet they're also laying down a recording of all sorts of things that have happened in the past so that we have a much better understanding of what's happened. We kind of know that in terms of archaeology, and people might say, okay, well, that's neat. We know maybe a few hundred years with trees, but you can get information a lot farther back. And so now remember, our argument is that, okay, habitable planets are going to be better at these things than non-habitable planets. Well, guess what? If you compare our planet and those layering processes to other planets, they have nothing like this. They're just not really good data recording systems like that on planets that are hostile to life. So it's just yet another example. And so we think, look, when you walk around and you look at trees, be astounded, but also realize they're data recorders. They're rolled up scrolls recording data about what we're doing and what other people are doing and what the atmosphere is like at this moment.
Let's get into something really controversial, climate change.
Oh, yeah.
You know, how does the privileged planet hypothesis inform the current climate change debate? I mean, we're talking, Jay, about politicians being convinced that we need to spend tens, maybe hundreds of trillions of dollars on climate change, that it's an existential problem, that's the greatest problem. I mean, kids are afraid, the fear-mongering is intense. But the privileged planet hypothesis actually helps inform us here.
It does. And so just for people that only follow this superficially, the sort of climate change catastrophist claim is that our contributions of CO2 in particular into the atmosphere, CO2 is this three atom molecule, and so it's a greenhouse gas, is causing the surface of the planet to heat up more, far more than it would naturally, and that's going to lead to catastrophic types of climate that's, as you said, going to be catastrophic to humans and to life. First thing to note is that there's no justification for those extreme claims. And so if you even read the overheated Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports from the UN, none of those never justify this. They'll say, okay, yeah, we think based upon our computer models that we'll get between 1 and 5 degrees centigrade warming in the next 100 years. There's really not even a justification for that. But notice that in either of those cases, it's not catastrophic. I mean, anyone living at upper latitudes experiences a heck of a lot more than 5 degrees change in temperature every day. And so the idea that, you know, this would somehow lead to the extinction of life is just nonsense. But then the second question would be, okay, how sensitive is the climate to additions of CO2? And the great thing here is that we actually have data. As I mentioned, those recording devices, we have data about what's happened in the distant past. There are times in the distant past when the atmosphere had vastly, vastly more carbon dioxide. I mean, order of magnitude more carbon dioxide than it does now. There was no runaway greenhouse effect. It didn't wipe out life. In fact, plant life really likes carbon dioxide. It's plant food. Ironically, if you get too low concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, below 150 parts per million, plant life ceases. So that's the catastrophe. And so the fact that our planet actually records information allows us to test these predictive computer models. The computer models, remember, are just programs on computers in which you plug in variables based on your assumptions and see what would happen if your assumptions are true. They have to be tested against reality. But we already know the climate is not nearly as sensitive to carbon dioxide as these models predict. And we know that precisely because the Earth has been recording this information. Now, here's the ironic thing, is that if you think about what's really kind of worrisome in distant past climate, it's not warm patches, it's ice ages. When a huge amount of the Earth is covered in, you know, a couple of miles of ice. That's the thing we ought to worry about. And we're actually kind of due for another ice age. It may be that our contribution of CO2 through industrial processes, while not making all that much difference in terms of warming, may help helping stave off another ice age. That's still kind of an open question, but we think there's actually some evidence of that. And so this is obviously sort of directly related to this. And I can tell you, Hank, I mean, Guillermo and I started following all this debate in 1999 when we started on the book. The arguments have gotten worse and worse and worse on the other side for catastrophe. And so it makes me really sad that people don't know enough about the evidence that they just sort of they believe these hysterical claims.
So you have someone, and not to pick on any particular politician, but Joe Biden, he's kind of an easy target.
Yeah.
But you hear him talk about this dogmatically. Do you think, I mean, this is a speculative question, do you think he really understands climate change in any comprehensive sense?
No, I don't think so. In fact, the only... There was a politician, Inhofe, Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma, that really followed the science. Al Gore, though he was wrong about a lot of stuff, at least was kind of interested in the science. Now, he infamously misinterpreted data from past climate, in which he claimed that wherever you get an increase in CO2, you get an increase in temperature. And so he was assuming that was a sort of causal relationship, but he had messed up the sequence, because what actually happens is that you get the temperature increase about 800 years before the CO2 increase. And so he'd actually sort of reversed cause and effect. And the reason for that is that when it's cool, the ocean can hold more CO2, and when it's warm, it releases it. So even the New York Times had to correct Al Gore on that in his documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. But he followed it. But most politicians that I've seen don't have any obvious understanding of this at all. I assume most of them are sincere, but they're just listening to their sort of selected experts. But notice that if you're a politician that wants to increase your power, especially your power over people's choices and over the economy, climate change hysteria gives you a justification for that, because you can say, well, yeah, all things being equal, people should be free to make choices about transportation and fuel use, but there's this existential threat. And so for the common good, we're going to have to tell you exactly what you want to do. That's the net zero campaign, this idea that we're going to, by 2050 or even 2030, contribute no net carbon emissions, no more CO2 to the atmosphere. Well, this is completely insane. This is never going to happen. China and India are still developing. They're not going to quit doing it. And so that's why I think we should just look askance at politicians talking about this, because it's a justification for them to increase their power over us, even if they're sincere. I think that's basically what this is about. And very few of them, so far as I can tell, have actually spent any time studying the details.
Yeah, so for all of us, many years ago, I learned from you a particular sequence that'll help all of us. You taught us really how to ask the right questions and then how to ask the right questions in the right sequence. So when you're confronted with something like climate change, you actually know what to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so this is the four questions, which is probably maybe the thing that I've developed that went the farthest was just these four questions. So somebody says, do you believe in global warming or climate change? That's actually a bundle of different claims, sort of put together. So the question you want to ask is, okay, first, is it warming, right? Is the earth warming? That's just that straightforward empirical question. Is there a warming trend if you take some baseline, say 1850 to the present? That's just what's happening, right? So let's go look at the evidence. The second question is, are we causing it? That is human activity the main or primary cause of it? So that's a separate question, right? That's going to be the cause. Something's happening. What's causing it is a different question. The ice caps could be melting, polar bears could be drowning. That doesn't tell you whether humans are doing anything to it. The third question is it bad? That is, let's assume that the Earth's warming. Let's assume humans are causing it. Is it bad? That is the warming bad, and is the contribution of CO2 to the atmosphere bad? The only way you could say that warming is bad is if you knew that the optimum global temperature was. That is, what's the optimum average global temperature? If we knew what that was, then you'd say, okay, well, are we moving toward it or away from it? Climate alarmists assume that we're moving away from it, that somehow it's cooler than it is now. But there's actually no evidence that that's the case. It could be very well that the optimum temperature, say, for human life or plant life is a little warmer than it is now. So that's at least a debatable question. And then the fourth question is, let's assume the answer to the first three is yes, that the Earth's warming, we're causing it, it's bad. Would any of the advised policies make any difference? And that's an economic question. It's actually really easy. The Kyoto Protocol, initially in the 90s, we knew would cost trillions of dollars and make no difference. The Paris Accords, the UN Paris Accords, which countries generally did not abide by, would cost a lot and make no difference. Net zero would cost, net zero would just basically move us back to hunter-gatherer stage or something like that, probably. So the cost would be immense, and it still wouldn't probably make a difference. And then I've since added a fifth question, what should we do instead? So in other words, the policies that are being advised are crazy. What should we do instead? Well, we know that the wealthier a country is, the more technologically advanced, the more they're able to adapt to things. So if whatever happens, right, if we have an ice age, if we have increased warming, the wealthier a country is, the easier it's going to be for them to adapt to it. So what we should do is pursue policies, global policies and trade policies that help poor countries become wealthier so that they can adapt to it just as well as we can. And the bonus is that as countries get wealthier, they get more concerned about environmental issues. And so if you're really poor and you're using dung for fuel in your hut, you're not concerned about what parts per million of CO2 are in the atmosphere. But when a country gets wealthy, we start worrying about things like the purity of the water in the air. And so I think that's the answer. Whatever ultimately you think about those questions, what we really should be doing if we care about people is helping the rest of the world get wealthy.
Yeah, so a couple of things. There has to be a balance here, though, right? Because we are called to be good stewards of God's creation. You're not negating that.
Not at all.
I mean, that's an imperative.
Absolutely.
We have to be good stewards. So, yeah, it's fantastic for us to be good stewards. But on the other hand, we can't give in to pseudoscience.
That's right. And this is I think this is honestly the reason that Christians get buffaloed by this, is that our compassion and our correct theology gets weaponized against us. So they say, look, you believe that we should be stewards of the world. God's, told us to be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, to till the garden and keep it. And climate change is the worst environmental disaster in a generation. So Christians need to get on board. That's a kind of there's some elision there logically. To be a good steward, right, is in other words, we do need to tend this. So I would say that's why we should find out what we're doing, right? And find out if it's actually harming things, let's fix it. I just think that the hysteria about climate change is overblown and based on bad arguments and bad inferences. And moreover, it tends to suck the air out of the room when it comes to real environmental concerns. There are legitimate environmental concerns with respect to toxins, and I worry about certain food additives and things that we have in the water that we're not paying attention to. We've been good at getting the big toxins out, but I think there's, look, we're doing something to the environment and our surroundings that it, to increase, massive increase in chronic diseases, especially among kids. Could be an environmental thing. We're not focusing on that. We're focusing on these kind of things having to do with climate change that I don't think are sort of well justified. So if you want to be a good steward and you want to care about the environment, the first thing you got to do is be discerning so that you can focus on things that actually help and not focus on things that actually hurt.
Yeah, discernment. You know, there's another thing that comes to mind, and you do write about this in your book as well, earthquakes. And I'm thinking about not only earthquakes, but hurricanes. I mean, we've just had two incredibly catastrophic hurricanes. And a lot of people will say, look, earthquakes, hurricanes are all signs that we're in a global warming catastrophe. The earthquakes are more frequent and more powerful. The hurricanes are more frequent, more powerful, et cetera. A lot of that is based on misinformation, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's so strange. And so people will, they'll take, for instance, a comparison. If you're to do sort of property damage in Florida in 2024 from a hurricane compared to property damage in 1700. Well, there's almost no property damage in 1700, not because there are no hurricanes, but because nobody was building stuff there, right? And so you're not comparing apples and apples. So the relevant question is, okay, if warming is causing an increase in intensity of hurricanes, cyclones, tornadoes, let's look at the evidence. Anyone can do this. You can go online. There's absolutely no trend. There is no trend of increasing frequency, of increasing intensity of hurricanes or tornadoes. And in fact, weirdly, on some measures, there seems to be a kind of a declining trend. The problem is that every hurricane and every tornado is used as an example of climate change. And so that people come to interpret these events with that kind of framework, forgetting that, okay, there've always been hurricanes. So the only way to test that claim would be to look and see if there's like a trend line of increasing intensity and deadliness. And there just isn't one. So there's no reason to think that that's the case. Moreover, even on a kind of climate change theory is that the warming is going to happen primarily at the poles and not at the equator. And it's actually the difference between the temperature difference between the equatorial regions and the poles that give rise to hurricanes. So if anything, just on the theory itself, you'd expect hurricane intensity to decrease. But there's a kind of, there's just a rhetorical need for this. And so I always say, you know, when a cold thing happens, that's weather. When a hot thing happens, that's climate change. And, you know, they just count on everyone. If we have a year that happens to have low hurricane frequency, then nobody's going to talk about it. If we have a year like this in which we have a couple of really bad ones, it's going to be all climate change all the time, right? But what they're giving us an interpretive framework so that we will see these things as sign of the theory, when in fact that's not how you would do this. These are just individual data points.
I want to talk about some other very interesting thing. In chapter 4 of your book, it's titled Peering Up, and you talk about the transparent atmosphere. And you talk about it as one of the most eerie coincidences known to science. So you put a great deal of emphasis on this, and I want you to unpack that for a moment.
Absolutely. And so it's important to realize that just not any part of the electromagnetic spectrum would be useful for chemical life. And so like people would say, well, okay, if you know, you're around a planet in which you didn't get visible light on the surface, but maybe you got X-ray or microwave light, then life would just evolve to use that that part of the electromagnetic spectrum. No, that just misunderstands the kind of basic needs for life in this universe. It needs to be based on carbon. Carbon is the element that is what's called metastable. So it's stable enough that you can build three-dimensional complex molecules like proteins. You can code information when DNA, but not so stable that it doesn't undergo chemical reactions. So it's this kind of sweet spot. So you need, if you're going to have life in the universe, information-bearing life, it's going to be based on carbon, and then you're going to need a solvent for it where these reactions can take place. Well, that's water. So water and carbon are perfectly suited to each other. Carbon chemistry is most reactive over this narrow range of temperatures over which water is liquid. And it's the same kind of thing in the electromagnetic spectrum. There are going to be certain types of energy, think of it that way, sort of energy from a star that life will find useful, and some that's not useful or is deadly. All right. So our atmosphere, which is another kind of feature of the same life, is going to need a nitrogen and oxygen-rich atmosphere. There's lots of choices. They're not all like that. That's, of course, what we have. Nitrogen-rich and oxygen-rich atmosphere is what's needed chemically for these life forms. It also happens to be transparent to the visible part of the electromagnetic spectrum, so that part of the spectrum that's needed for life gets through the atmosphere to the surface. But the atmosphere is not transparent to other parts of the spectrum. And because of the magnetic field we have around the Earth, a lot of the kind of deadly stuff that we might otherwise encounter is blocked. Now that's interesting, because you could ask this other question. So if you were to look at the electromagnetic spectrum, you've got the short wavelengths or gamma and X-ray on one end, and then you get radio waves on the other. And it just means the wavelengths are really, really large. And then think of the visible light as that light that's, we think of as when we put it through a prism as in a rainbow. That is a really, really tiny slice of the sort of range of the electromagnetic spectrum in the universe. Now ask yourself the question, if you had access to only like a little sliver of that for discovering the universe, which sliver would you want to have access to? Well, it turns out the kind of the most information-rich part of the stuff that you want is in the visible part of the spectrum. So for life, you need an atmosphere that has the right kind of chemical elements. That constituents of chemical elements allows the right kind of energy to come from your host star. And that's the same little part of the spectrum that's the most informative for doing science. That's just crazy. I mean, and so we're talking, the numbers are so sort of mind-boggling, that when you realize this, you think, well, this is either the eeriest thing I've ever seen or there's some kind of trick. But it really is just absolutely wild. And one final thing on this, Hank, because you might say, okay, yeah, but okay, if that's really useful, then of course you're going to want to be able to see as well as you can. But of course, we get clouds in our atmosphere. So sometimes you live in Seattle, probably never seen the Aurora Borealis, for instance, because it's cloudy. Well, remember we were talking about the constrained optimization a few minutes ago. As it happens, yeah, you want to have a clear atmosphere for seeing the planets around the sun and to be able to look at the moon and to see the distant galaxies with a telescope. And so you need a clear atmosphere, but you don't want a perfectly clear atmosphere in the sense that it's totally dry, because there's a whole other set of things that you need to discover that require a hydrological cycle, that require water in the atmosphere. One of those things is rainbows. You only get a rainbow if you have water that has water droplets at just the right size to be able to refract the visible light into the rainbow, which was actually crucial for scientific discovery. And so really what you want is a partly cloudy atmosphere for doing all of these things. And so, that's sort of counterintuitive, because people think, well, yeah, what about clouds? Actually, those are really useful. So even though it can be frustrating if you've got a sky viewing night and it gets cloudy, overall for science, this is exactly what you'd want.
You mentioned some things in this discussion so far that I think are either elements that are underappreciated or elements that get a bad rap. For example, you just mentioned water, underappreciated. Carbon dioxide, I think, gets a bad rap.
Yes, absolutely. It does. I mean, water is crazy. It's got all these weird anomalous properties. So, for instance, it's lighter when it's frozen. So, in its solid state, is lighter than in its liquid state. Almost every other thing that you can think of, every compound and every element, that's not how it works. But this is why water is so uniquely suited for life. And so, one example of this, so you get freezing, you get the oceans that freeze on the poles. Well, if ice didn't float, if it sunk, that ice would freeze up, it would sink to the bottom of the ocean, it'd be out of access to the sun, the energy from the sun, and so more would freeze and it would keep sinking, and you'd end up with this kind of almost entirely frozen ocean. As it is, the surface freezes And it insulates the water underneath it. So that's true. The kind of fact that ice floats ends up being important at the planetary level for other reasons. It's important for plant life and cellular life. And so water is this, even though it's just, a couple of atoms of hydrogen and an atom of oxygen, it's crazy when it comes to its fitness for life. And then carbon dioxide also, I mean, we treat it as if it's a pollutant. Well, guess what? Plants take carbon dioxide and they use it, right? It's a part of their life cycle, and then they give us the oxygen. So it's really wild that this trace compound, this trace molecule that's in our atmosphere that is the result both of respiration of animal life, but also plant food, and the result of industrial activity should somehow be treated as if it's an environmental toxin, which it just absolutely is not.
This is off the wall, but should we all be driving electric cars?
I mean, yeah, like I, if you were in, I, it's funny you say this, Hank, because I actually really wanted to get a Tesla. I get a not a new car, but a slightly used car about every 10 years. And in DC, the Tesla is ideal because it's like a 30 mile commute. They don't go anywhere else. And you get all sorts of benefits. In fact, my neighborhood has a free hookup out here. I could get free power. The problem is that if everybody were doing that, we don't have enough copper wire. We simply don't have the capacity in the grid for everybody to be able to do that. So even if you thought for various reasons, yeah, it makes sense to have electric cars so we're not hauling heavy fuel around with us, we don't have the capacity to do this. In order to do it, to build these batteries, we are relying on rare earth minerals from places like China, which have terrible environmental records. And for me, if anyone is really serious about converting from internal combustion engines to electric cars, the only way that's ever at all realistic, or that we're even going to increase the kind of percentage of electric cars, is to increase the power of the grid. And the only way to do that without increasing the use of fossil fuel for the power plants would be nuclear power. And yet a lot of the same people don't want to do that. So I think it's, I don't know if they imagine that compost and some windmills and some solar power is somehow gonna do this. There's just basic physics preventing that. So yeah, I suspect we could be one or two battery innovations away from it making more sense to use battery-powered cars. But we want to follow market dynamics on that. The reason almost everyone's still driving internal combustion engines is because at the moment, it's the most abundant, least expensive fuel for those purposes for most people. That's the reason. It's not because people hate the earth. It's because it's still, all things being equal, the kind of best fuel to use.
I always say contrast is the conduit to clarity. And in chapter 5 of your book, you talk about the pale blue dot. So here's my question. How does Earth and our solar system compare with the thus discovered, the planets and the exoplanets that we have
Yeah.
discovered thus far?
That's right. So when we first wrote the book in 2004, there were about 100 exoplanets that we had detected. It's now, I think, over 5,000
Say that one
actually.
more time. 20 years ago, we knew about 100.
100.
Now, 5,000 or more.
About 5,000. That's right. And so we're getting better and better. We still can't quite detect Earth-sized planets because they perturb their stars so little. So the first ones we detected, because we're not seeing the planets themselves, what we're seeing is the effect of the planets on the sort of the gravitational interactions of the planets, or the transit of the planet in front of the star along our line of sight. So you can detect either kind of a slight dip in the light, or we have instruments to be able to detect slight wobbles in the star, and then you can sort of infer the orbit and the size of the planet, basically. And so we now know, yeah, there's lots of planets around other stars. When the book first came out, I can tell you, Hank, every NASA press release would talk about an extrasolar planet, the most Earth-like planet ever discovered, and we'd look at it, and it would be something like Jupiter, except it would be in this wildly elliptical orbit, in most of half spending most of its life inside the orbit of Mercury, right? So a hot Jupiter, completely useless to life. And if there were an Earth-like planet in that system, it would have gotten destroyed by that planet. And so we had this happen so much that I finally started telling reporters, look, call us when you find an Earth-like planet that is as Earth-like as Mars, because Mars is the most Earth-like planet yet known other than Earth. It is around the star, so we know it's in a habitable system. It's roughly the same kind of size and mass as the Earth. It has some of the same elements. It's only slightly outside the orbit of the Earth. It can even exchange material with the Earth, and yet it's utterly lifeless. And so that tells you basically Venus just on the inside of our orbit and Mars on the outside tells you how narrow the conditions are for an Earth-like planet, even in an otherwise habitable system. They're totally lifeless. And then, of course, nobody expects to find life around, and say in Jupiter or Saturn, which are gas giants, so they don't have stable surfaces, or the outer gas or ice giants, Jupiter and Uranus. What we're doing now is we're looking at some of the moons. So we have just NASA has just sent a mission. It's just taken off to look at Europa, which is a moon around Jupiter. It's a very interesting moon. We spend a bunch of time talking about Europa in the book. And so what's interesting about it is that it has this solid ice surface. And so, as we said, ice floats. So maybe there's a liquid ocean just underneath it, and maybe there's life inside there. Well, that's basically saying, okay, we know life's important. So any place or water is important for life. So any place we can find water, we'll have life. Well, we're getting ready to test that by going to Europa. And we think, sorry, you need a heck of a lot more. But in some ways, I think that shows you how much we've downgraded things in the 20th century. In the 30s, Americans panicked over Orson Welles' radio program, War on the Worlds, because they mistook it for an actual newscast about Martians invading Earth. Well, no one would fall for that now. We know that there are no Martians because we've actually been there and can see it. And so now what we're doing is we're looking for evidence of liquid water on the in the distant past on Mars, and we're sending billion-dollar probes to Europa in a moon around Jupiter. So in many ways, that's the trend line that we've seen from imagining everything we see from the moon to Mars has life on it, to realizing, okay, well, let's at least try to see if there's water somewhere. The reality is 5,000 extrasolar planets, not one of those is even as Earth-like as Mars. And so not one of them is likely to have life on it.
Your book is titled Privileged Planet, and I want to focus on that word planet for just a moment because planets play an incredible role in our existence and survival.
Yeah, they do. I mean, of course, astrologers, this was this astrological claim is that the sort of location of planet, by the way, is based on a word that just means wanderers. So they people that are accustomed to seeing the night sky, like the ancients would have been, would notice that this background of stars that stays more or less the same, the pattern, and then you get these wanderers in the foreground, which we call they call the planets. And astrologers would say, well, if you were born under Jupiter and Jupiter is in a particular constellation, that supposedly sort of said something about your destiny. And I don't think there's really anything to that at all. Nevertheless, the planets do play a role in our existence. And you can think of it as Jupiter and Saturn are like giant guardians of the inner part of the solar system, because our solar system is not just the sun and eight or nine moons or planets, if you count nine, if you count Pluto. It's also populated by billions or trillions of comets in the outer part of the solar system that spend most of their time way out in the outer reaches. But every so often, they're still gravitationally connected to the sun. And so they will eventually come into the inner part of the solar system into our neighborhood. Well, now, comets, if you encounter a large comet and you're a planet with life on it, that's a negative encounter. They can sterilize life. But because we have these giant planets in our part of the solar system, they end up taking a lot of hits for us. So they actually protect the inner part of the solar system and make it much more habitable. So we think you need more than just the right kind of sun and the right kind of planet by itself. You probably need a system very much like the one that we have. Now, at the moment, we're fairly confident that Jupiter and Saturn play a role in our existence. We'd like to, find evidence that, in fact, the other planets also play a role. But at the moment, it's like we focus on the things that we know at this point. And so, I can't say one way or the other what role, say, Mercury would play. But we do know that at least the large planets in the outer part of the solar system make the inner part of the solar system where we are much more habitable.
What happens to you, to your temperature level, when you hear someone like Neil deGrasse Tyson talk about the sun? You just mentioned the sun, and say the sun, he appends the word mediocre to sun.
Yeah.
So the sun is just mediocre. What happens to your temperature when you hear that?
I'm trying to work on my temperature, actually, so that I just say, well, what is mediocre exactly? And so presumably mediocre just means sort of average or something like that. And so I guess maybe he's saying, look, if, in terms of size, maybe or something, it's sort of, it's not a tiny star like an M dwarf, but it's not a blue supergiant or something. I don't know, because you'd say, okay, well, if we're going to grade stars with respect to mediocrity and grandiosity, how are you going to grade them? Well, it's not going to be size, is it, or something like that? It's going to be like, okay, which ones are most conducive to life in a planetary environment? That is, which ones are the best host in a planetary system for a life-giving planet? Well, it's ours. It's precisely, it's yellow dwarf like the one that we have. It's very stable. All stars are slightly variable, but what you don't want is a star that's just constantly varying its output of energy. You need stability so that if you have a planet around a fairly circular orbit, you know, it's going to get roughly the same amount of energy over long periods of time. It needs actually to be just the right size. So if it's too small, like a red giant, which is really what that's, those are the mediocre stars that are just all over the place. To be in the Goldilocks zone around a red dwarf, you have to be, the planet has to be much, much, much closer. And because of the inverse square law of gravity, the closer you get, the more kind of intense that the gravitational attraction is. So you get in the Goldilocks zone around a red dwarf. What's going to happen over time is that your planet's not going to be able to orbit on its axis like ours does. It's going to get locked in. It's called tidally locked, where the same part of one face surface of the planet faces the sun during its entire year. And so you're going to get one hot side and one side that's frozen solid. And so it's going to be almost certainly lifeless, or at least hostile to life. If the star is too large, it's going to give off all sorts of sterilizing radiation. Also, if you're too close around a red dwarf, you're going to get solar flares that are going to affect your planet. So there's just so many details to go into. But the gist of it is that you need a lot of stuff to go right in terms of the composition and the size and the status of the star, where it is it by itself? And once you add all those things up, if we say, okay, the most significant star is going to be the one that's most, the best hostess for life, that's our sun. It's going to be small yellow dwarfs that are by themselves in the right neighborhood within a galaxy. And so it's very hard to justify the claim that our sun is mediocre, unless you're just sort of, I don't know, adding them up, by sort of lining them up by size or something, and then saying, well, the sun is kind of in the middle. I mean, it's like the only sense I can even make of that claim.
You've already sort of talked about this, but I think it bears emphasis, and that is our place in the Milky Way galaxy. How significant is the precise placement of the pale blue dot, or Earth, in the flattened spiral arm of the Milky Way galaxy?
It's really important. I mean, the first thing is you got to be the right kind of galaxy. So you could be in a galaxy that doesn't have a lot of heavy elements in it, or that has very erratic and irregular orbits. So you don't want a large spiral galaxy like we have. But as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, the center of the galaxy is hostile to life because of it's much denser with stars, black holes, sterilizing radiation. So you don't want to be anywhere near that, but you don't want to be too far from the center of the galaxy, or you end up with this basically a lot of hydrogen and helium. And so you can't build rocky planets. And then you don't want to be in the spiral arms. And so you want to be basically midway out. We're 27,000 light years from the center to the edge of the galaxy. So it's roughly the galaxy, if you think of it from edge to edge, is about 100,000 light years across. And so that's exactly where we are. It's like a dotted line around the galaxy, not including the spiral arms. But now then the second question would be, okay, so if you could only pick one place for doing science, where would that be? Well, even if you could exist in the center of the galaxy, you would not want to be there, because if you're in the center of the galaxy, you couldn't tell whether a source of radiation wouldn't be obvious if it was coming from nearby, from inside your galaxy, or from another galaxy, or from the background radiation, because they'd be symmetrical on your sky. So everywhere you pointed, you know, your radio telescope, it would sort of look the same. As it is, because we're halfway out The galaxy appears asymmetrical across our sky. So if you go up to Colorado Springs at night or someplace up on a mountain, you'll see that Milky Way band across the sky. You're looking edge on at the thickness of the galaxy, and so the density of the stars. Well, that's how it is in the radio part of the spectrum too. You're going to notice that, and so you'd say, okay, that's coming from the galaxy, so that's nearby. What's this weird radiation that we're getting uniformly in every direction in the microwave part of the spectrum? That's the cosmic background radiation. So it actually been hard to detect that if we'd been in the center of the galaxy, even if you could have existed there. And of course, if you're in a murky part of the galaxy, you might not even be able to see the planets in your own system. You certainly wouldn't be able to see stars, and you certainly wouldn't be able to see galaxies outside the galaxy. So long and the short of it is, if you could pick one place in the galaxy for doing science, it's in the galactic habitable zone. In other words, in that part of the galaxy that's the best place for life itself.
Another interesting thing, and I think you point this out in your book as well, that's probably where I got this from, but there's a lot of talk on the internet about how telescopes have undermined Big Bang cosmology.
Yeah, and I don't sort of get this because there's always a kind of skepticism because of the James Webb Space Telescope, because what it's allowing us to do is basically, so to remind listeners, so when you're looking into the distant universe, you're not looking at it at something at this moment, because light has a finite speed. And so what you're seeing is you're sort of sampling different time periods in the universe. And so because the universe is large, we're able to visually sample different time periods. James Webb allows us to sort of reach farther back. And so lots of cosmologists had these models of galactic evolution, as it's called, and cosmic evolution, in which the models assumed, okay, how long did it take from the Big Bang and the decoupling and that sort of formation of elements in order for us to get galaxies like we see now? And the assumption was that it takes a really long time to get that. And so then all of a sudden, we're discovering what were considered to be mature galaxies. And so some people say, oh, well, that totally undermines the evidence of a Big Bang. That is the evidence of a finite past. No, not at all. What it undermines is these models. It looks like, gosh, things had to be really fine-tuned beyond what we thought, because it's surprising how quickly you can get galaxy formation once you get the elements in place. It's sort of like finding life on Earth almost as soon as life could exist, right? That tells you something. And so people, in some ways, were so attached to their theoretical models of how this was supposed to have happened, that when we finally get some direct evidence of it, it's like they get totally skeptical. Instead, they need to go back to the drawing board, because clearly they got something wrong about what happens when galaxies form early in the history of the universe.
I want to ask you a question that one of my grandkids might ask me. They might say something like, "Why is the night sky dark, Papa?" But that's something you address in your book.
Absolutely, and it's called Olber's paradox. This is a, in some ways, I said earlier that we just in the 20th century finally have empirical evidence that the universe had a beginning because of the cosmic background radiation, the cosmic expansion. In fact, we've always had evidence of that. The fact that the night sky is dark, it means that the universe is not infinite in expanse, and it hasn't always been like this. Because if the universe had always been like this, same basic kind of density, and there are an infinite number of stars, then at every point from an infinite amount of time ago, there should have been a star pointing in our direction. And so the night sky should not be the night sky. It should be as bright as the surface of the sun. The fact that it's dark is itself evidence that the universe is not infinite either in space or in time, which is a really remarkable thing. The other thing is that it's only because of the night sky that we're actually able to see a lot of stuff. You can't see distant stars and things like that during the day. And so the evidence was always there. It was called Olber's paradox, though, Hank, because it's only a paradox if you assume the universe is eternal and infinite. If it's not a paradox, you say, well, yeah, of course, maybe this, yeah, the sky is dark. I guess the universe must not be eternal. That would have been the kind of more natural inference.
Well, good answer. And one of the things that you point out in your book, and I mean, maybe this is as basic, not in the sense of unimportant, but basic and important, is that our universe is fine-tuned for not only discovery, but for the existence of life itself.
That's right. And so everything we've talked about so far is like, think of it as the fine tuning of the stuff you need to get right at the local level. But then you have the question, okay, well, what about the universal properties of the universe, the stuff that's true everywhere that govern the structure of molecules and the elements and planets? And so there's sort of basically three of these kind of universal properties. So there's the initial conditions. So what that would be is, okay, how do things have to be set up right at the beginning in order to have a universe like we have now? Then there are the laws. So like the law of gravity that people will learn in physics. And then within the laws, there are these sort of variables that might be M or C or something, and they're constants. And so these are just, they're constant. What that means is they're just literally constant. They're the same everywhere. And so they're these kind of mathematical properties of the universe that are true absolutely everywhere. Well, physicists in the 1950s started realizing, okay, so you've got the gravitational force constant. So that's that kind of big force. You've got electromagnetic and the strong and the weak nuclear forces. So these are called the four fundamental forces. This is where it was first noticed. And some physicists said, you know, it's weird because if you fiddled with the electromagnetic constant, made it different, or you fiddled with the gravitational force constant, you would not get a universe that had life in it. In fact, you probably wouldn't get a universe that had planets or galaxies. As it happens, it's like these constants are very precisely tuned for the existence of life. In fact, it's called the fine-tuning problem. Well, it's only a problem if you don't really like the idea of the universe having been fine-tuned. But if you just, let's just say, okay, if it quacks like a duck and looks like a duck, maybe it's a duck. If the universe looks fine-tuned, maybe it is. If it looks fine-tuned for life, maybe it is. And that's again, a basic discovery of 20th century physics that confirms the theistic worldview. Lots of physicists have spent decades trying to find loopholes to get around it, but it's an extraordinary thing. And it's strong enough that it actually has led some atheists, just itself, like the late Anthony Flew, was persuaded by the fine tuning and the evidence for design and DNA to move from atheism to deism. And Hank, even my debate way back in 2008, when I debated the late new atheist Christopher Hitchens at Stanford, was about God and science. And he ended up pivoting to deism, right? Because he realized, okay, the argument for fine tuning does sound like there's some purpose in the universe. So he said, yeah, maybe deism is true, but God doesn't care anything about us, which I thought was kind of an interesting concession. It's really not a good time to be an atheist if you are honest with the evidence from physics and cosmology.
Yeah. You know, I want to read a quote from your book that caught my attention. I wrote it down here on a piece of paper. But this in the context of features of our universe that allow us to discover the laws of nature. You say the universe is an excellent tutor. It has not been so demanding as to ensure failure, but instead has presented us with worthy challenges that we can meet with diligence. And when I read that, I immediately thought of Proverbs chapter 25, verse 2. It is the glory of God to conceal a matter. It is the glory of God's people to search out a matter.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and we've known that. I mean, anyone that studies scripture like you have for a lifetime, you can read Genesis 1 and a 7, you can read Genesis 1 to a 7-year-old. It's sort of simple and easy to get. And it's bottomless, though, the text, when you especially get into the Hebrew. That's how the created order is. And we were talking there specifically about the way in which, okay, if you had to go from, say, a hunter-gatherer stage when you don't have a written language, and to figure anything out scientifically, you needed Einstein's general theory of relativity. There's no way to get there from here, right? But as it happens, it's like the world has been set up so that fairly difficult, it takes work, but we're able to figure things out. And then sort of each theoretical stage helped us to understand some things. And then it gave us a platform to discover the next stage. So you needed Kepler to get Newton, and you needed Newton to get Einstein. And if you had to go straight to Einstein without the intermediate steps, you wouldn't have gotten there theoretically. And that was something that honestly we kind of realized late in the book, this stair-stepping of physical discoveries and then theoretical discoveries. And then Christian philosopher Robin Collins has developed this more beyond what we did in terms of the kind of the theoretical stair-stepping in which God has set stuff up so that if we're diligent, we can discover these things, but it's still a worthy enterprise. It's not like some kind of fake game that, a parent will give to their 6-year-old so that they're sure to win. It's something that is a genuine accomplishment when we discover these things.
We hear this little phrase over and over again in various contexts: size matters. Comment on size. Is our mark of smallness a symptom of disrepute? Is our puny size in comparison to the universe something that denigrates the greatness of Earth?
I don't know why. I mean, yeah, clearly the fact that, let's say a star, just a big lump of a giant lump of hydrogen gas or something that's a light year across. Okay, spatially, that's huge compared to the Earth or compared to an individual human being. But surely a single human being is much more magnificent than just this kind of cloud of hydrogen. And so size is not a specially good measure in the abstract for significance. But as I mentioned earlier, and we actually do the calculation in the book, that the irony is that on a kind of logarithmic scale, the sort of human Earth size scale is actually in the middle of size scales that we know in the universe. So if you think of the universe as a whole, as the big scale, and you go all the way down to, say, quarks on the small scale, the human Earth size scale is in the middle, which is interesting. So we're not tiny and we're not huge, but that's where you'd want to be for scientific discovery as it happens. So if we were just to say an order of magnitude smaller for this, or the size of ants, most of the universe would have been inaccessible to us. They're kind of just basic physical dynamics in terms of the kind of instruments you'd need, what you'd need to be able to control fire, the size of lenses you'd need for telescopes, these kinds of things. In order to see large structures, you need to be about our size scale. On the other hand, if we were much larger, it would have been very hard for us to detect things at a very small scale. So for scientific discovery, we're actually right in the sweet spot, but it would be really easy to miss that if you somehow thought our middling size compared to a blue supergiant somehow made us unimportant.
Is that constrained optimization again? Because one of the points you make in the book is that our size is perfect for the adaptation of technology.
That's right. It's absolutely constrained optimization. And our friend and colleague Michael Denton has actually taken this farther. In fact, he has a series, Discovery Institute Press, on privileged species, the kind of technological stuff, which we talk a bit about in the book. But so much of technology depends upon our ability to control fire. And, look, ants can't control fire because of their size. And so there's just this kind of weird interlocking features of this thing when you really start analyzing it, they get, as you said, eerie. And people that get the argument, Hank, like really early on, I think the first times we even presented this stuff, Guillermo spoke at a conference, I feel like it was around 2000 or 2001 at Yale. I was there, and a guy named Scott Minnich at the University of Idaho was there, and he heard our discussion about eclipses. It kept him awake all night. I mean, but this is a smart guy, a scientist who he got it right away. And he started running out the implications of this in his mind. And he thought, this was the eeriest thing I'd ever heard. Just eerie in the sense that it's like a wow, this is like a cosmic conspiracy that I didn't know anything about, which we think that's actually the right response.
Well, this discussion wouldn't be complete if we didn't talk about the Copernican principle. It's a myth, and like all great myths, it's a mixture of truth and falsehood. And you go through in your book why this myth is perpetuated and how we can actually defend the truth in light of this mythology.
Absolutely. And so, of course, it's called the Copernican principle. So you'd think, okay, well, it's based on Copernicus. Copernicus is the scientist who wrote the book on the revolution of the heavenly spheres in 1543, in which he proposed kind of mathematically that In fact, you understand the movement of the moon and the sun and the planets better if you think of the Earth as another one of the planets, with the moon rotating around us and the Earth rotating on its axis. And the movement of the sun then is just merely apparent, whereas we're one of the planets that's actually orbiting the sun. And he said, actually, this makes the movements make more sense than the previous idea, the pre-Copernican idea called the Aristotelian Ptolemaic view, which is that the Earth is this sort of stationary center and all the other, everything else that we see literally kind of goes around us. And so the Copernican principle, the myth, is that, well, what Copernicus discovered is that we're not in the center, that is, we're not in the important part of the universe, we're just a mere planet. And so what Copernicus did, he cast us into this position of mediocrity. Science has continued for several centuries. Every new scientific discovery just relegates us to a less and less important place. Okay, so that's the myth. But if you actually look at the history of science, that story appears in the 19th century. Not in the 1500s or the 1600s. The reason is because it completely gets the details wrong about what the pre-Copernican cosmology was. Anybody that knows Aristotle is going to know that Aristotle's physics, the Earth wasn't in the center because that was the important place to be. It's because it was one of the elements. It's the heavy element. That's where stuff falls. And so you're going to get the heavy Earth in the center. It's really the bottom of the universe, but it's also where death and decay are. It's where the detritus of the universe collects. The really important stuff is in the moon and above. It's made of this quintessence of this fifth element, of this kind of perfect, eternal, immutable matter that's separate from the Earth. And so it wasn't that the center was a sort of position of pride of place. And then if you take Dante's Christian interpretation of that, you read the Divine Comedy, the surface of the Earth is where humans live. We can die, right? We can ascend to the heavens, but we might go to hell. And if you're reading the Divine Comedy and you get to hell, well, the center of the universe, the center of the Earth, that's Satan, right? That's the real, that's the center of the universe in the kind of Christianized pre-Copernican cosmology. So in other words, the center of the universe for Copernicus was not the most important place to be. And it's only by reinterpreting that and counting on people not to understand the history that they could think that, oh, when Copernicus told us we weren't in the center of the universe, that meant we were unimportant. It's a terrible kind of bungling of the details of science. C.S. Lewis wrote a wonderful book describing all this called The Discarded Image. And so if you read Copernicus and then later Galileo actually says, you know, he thinks being a planet, we're reflecting the light of the sun. And that's a kind of glorious thing. And then Kepler realized later that actually, because we move, then we're not stationary, there will be a way for us to figure out the distances to some stars using a parallax measurement and trigonometry, which we actually did. So we're able to measure the distances to some stars just based upon their slight movement 6 months later. So we're on one side of the Earth, or the sun, and we measure a star where it is on the sky, and then measure it again 6 months later when you're on the other side of the sun. And if there's a slight variation with some trigonometry, you can figure out how far away that star is. So there's so much wrong with the Copernican myth. Nothing wrong with Copernicus and what he discovered, but he did not show us that we are insignificant by moving us from the so-called center. And there's nothing, the actual discoveries of science have not done that either. Yeah, the universe is a lot larger than maybe we imagined or realized. But that doesn't answer the question that we're most interested in, which is that the significance of us here, both as creatures, living creatures, but also as discoverers. If you ask the question the right way, you get a very different answer.
Yeah, I mean, this is very important to you. You devoted chapter 12 and 13 to eight principles that discredit this idea of mediocrity. But you also mentioned something, and I want you to make a pitch here, if you would. You mentioned something a number of times throughout the podcast, and it was, if you read, if yeah. you read this, if you read that, if you read this, make a pitch for reading again in our generation. Do you think that's even possible?
It's certainly possible, and I'm optimistic about the fact what I have seen. And so just as the education system generally keeps getting worse and worse and worse and worse, There's also pockets of light. I mean, there are amazing private schools. There are homeschool co-ops that we've been part of. The classical school movement is a wonderful development. The really good classical schools are actually designed around reading primary texts and help forcing kids not to listen to hour-long lectures, but to have to synthesize and articulate and analyze text. You can only be good at that if you learn to read, you learn to read deeply, are able to synthesize, and you're able to focus for long periods of time. And so I think that's how we renew the culture, is by preserving and renewing and recovering those habits, which were just the kind of basic thing that everybody got that was educated until a century or two ago. It's easy to notice all the stuff that's collapsing and easy not to notice these sort of pockets of light. We've been blessed to have been part of several of those movements, and so seeing what it does to kids. But honestly, Frank, anyone that's listening to us that has kids or has grandkids, if it's in your power, make sure that they have those kinds of educational options. They need to know the truths of the faith, truths of the creeds. They need to know the scriptures like the back of their hand, but they also need intellectual habits. They need discernment. They need the ability to focus and to read and to pay attention. Without those skills, none of this other stuff's going to work.
As we're doing this podcast, we're in the midst of an election cycle, and I've often said that the ballot box is necessary. However, our culture is being determined by far more than the ballot box. I mean, we have the educational institutions, which are broken. We have the environmental institutions, which are corrupt. We have the entertainment industry, which is seducing our culture in many, many different ways. Talk about that for a moment. I mean, this is really where the battle is won or lost.
It absolutely is. And as you know, I mean, I'm here in Washington, D.C., and I'm aware of how much the so-called deep state, but just the administrative state, which no one ever elects rules and policies that are implemented by all of these agencies in Washington, D.C., and almost all the power is there. But remember, there was another time about 2,000 years ago, the largest and most powerful empire, Rome, that spanned the known world at the time. That was the moment in which Christianity was born, and it was Christians were persecuted, and yet they overcame it, and in fact, eventually overtook it. And so there's no reason that we cannot have the same thing again. It's tempting. If you have a narrow time horizon, you might think, oh, nothing like this has ever happened. Actually, this is exactly how it started. We at least have the benefit of 2,000 years of Christian history to draw on. But I do think that we should think of ourselves much more like those early Christians. And we should steel ourselves to be prepared to fight and to suffer, just like those early Christians did, if we want to be part of transforming the world with the gospel, just as those early Christians did.
I'm thinking as you're speaking about Jonathan Wells, I just did a tribute to him and re-aired one of the podcasts I did with Jonathan Wells. You know, we talked about suffering. You know, when you take the stands that you take as an intellectual, as an educator, as a commentator, as a writer, you do pay a price.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the reality is, I was talking to my younger daughter yesterday. We were talking about these things, and I thought, and she realized this. She's a senior in college now at the University of Dallas, and she sort of realized, you know, if you were going to play it safe, you would have taken the opposite positions to all of your public positions. You should have taken the other side. And we were trying to figure out again, why is it that some people decide that, okay, well, I'm going to pay the price. And I said, it might be a neurodiversity for all I know. We don't care what people think about us, but it's also a kind of matter of priority. Are we more interested in the truth, even if it's costly, or are we interested in the approval of men and accolades? Jonathan Wells was someone that lived his life for decades as someone that just was willing to sacrifice for the truth. He did it in his own way in the 60s, spent time in the Citadel as a Vietnam War protester, and then ended up on the other side later politically and theologically. But he was convinced that materialism and the Darwinian ideology were a poison and a toxin to our culture, and he was willing to dedicate the last decades of his life to fighting it. And it's hard to see that he's gone, but he lived a rich life in which he was a stalwart defender of the truth as he saw it.
Yeah, and I love the way he did it. I was listening through that podcast again myself before we re-aired it, and I asked him about a couple of people who are very erudite, very sophisticated intellectuals. And I said, how can they say this or that or the other thing? And he basically pointed to what we're talking about right now. He said, well, you know, if you don't say that, you got to remember there is a huge price to be paid.
There absolutely is. And, you know, people think, oh, well, of course, in middle school, you know, there's a kind of herd instinct for kids. But oh man, the academia is absolutely terrible. And the truth of the matter is that we're all social creatures. We're all tempted by intellectual orthodoxies and social contagions. And we need to all pray both for the discernment to be able to separate the truth from falsehood, but also the bravery and the courage to be willing to first see the truth and then actually hold to it and to defend it, even if it's costly to us.
What's the anthropic principle and what's its relevance to what we were talking about earlier when we're talking about mediocrity?
Well, so the anthropic principle, the basic idea is that you should expect to see conditions compatible with your existence. So, in other words, if the conditions required for life are very precise and narrow, then you shouldn't expect to find yourself in just any old kind of circumstance. You should expect to find yourself in those kind of narrow set of conditions, because there's no other, if it were different, you wouldn't be able to see yourself. So that's the basic idea, is that you have to take account of it's kind of a selection effect. So if you need to be around a yellow dwarf star in order to be an organism, then that's where you're going to find yourself. And so we have to take account of that when we're developing these arguments. On the other hand, people will flip this and say, well, why is it that we see these things? And they'll say, well, because we had to see it this way, because if we weren't in these environments, we wouldn't sort of see it. But the question isn't, why do we observe a local environment or a universe compatible with our existence? The question is, why does such a universe exist? That's the question. We shouldn't be surprised, for instance, to discover that we're in a habitable part of the galaxy, but why there are galaxies with habitable regions, why those habitable regions are also the best places for doing science, those are the questions that we're actually interested in answering. And so people will often use a kind of legitimate aspect of the anthropic principle that, yeah, take account of these selection effects to try to explain away what is otherwise clear evidence of design. And so that's a serious mistake. So as you know, we spend a lot of time in the book just slicing the baloney thinly enough so that people see these differences.
One of the ways you explain away the significance, the fine-tuning of the universe, is through the multiverse theory. What's your take on that?
That's the kind of main escape hatch. So if you get to a very strong evidence for very precise fine-tuning of the universe, then somebody will say, well, maybe the universe is kind of like, just as we're around one planet and there's lots of other planets. So yeah, we're in a universe compatible with our existence, but maybe there are an infinite number of different universes, and we, of course, just happen to be in this one. So then you can say, so we shouldn't be surprised to see the universe that's compatible with our existence, but we also shouldn't be surprised, because if there's an infinite set of universes, then you know at least some of them will be compatible with life. Well, now what's happening here is it's an illicit intellectual move, because basically what you're saying is, something that looks like it's designed, this very much looks like it's designed, but we're going to invoke sort of other opportunities for chance to operate that we have no independent evidence of. So it'd be like if I saw me flip a coin 50 times and I did flip 50 heads in a row, and I only flipped it 50 times, you say, okay, that's got to be a trick coin. You say, well, no, because I mean, you know, there are infinite number of universes and an infinite number of people flipping coins someplace. Somebody's going to get 50 heads in a row. Nobody would buy that, because the much better explanation is that you've got a two-headed coin or that you've cheated. In the same way, interested in sort of invoking these things without evidence. In the same way, we don't have any independent evidence that those universes exist. So they're not anything like the evidence we have of other planets. And so to me, it's just quite clearly an attempt to explain away what would otherwise be prima facie evidence of design. And my sense is that, look, if you've got to invoke an infinite number of unobservable universes to explain the fine-tuning of this universe, that to me is a sign that you're sort of there's something wrong with your worldview.
Well, you've lost the argument.
Yeah.
So I got to ask you about this. Aliens. I remember when Tucker Carlson was on Fox, he used to have segments on UFOs.
Yeah.
And I noticed an interview with former President Donald Trump. Maybe he'll be the next president, I don't know. But he was asked about this question, and he said, well, I really don't believe in something to the effect, I don't really believe in the UFOs, but some very smart people I know do. What's your take on UFOs?
Well, I mean, so there's two questions. The broader question is there life elsewhere in the universe, whether we can detect it or not, right? And my answer is always, we don't really know. And God could have done things a lot of different ways. So let's just sort of be open to it. I don't think there's anything wrong with a SETI researchers looking at radio signals. And I think you could get an intelligent signal and we'd be able to tell. That would be interesting. UFOs, at least as they're normally understood, are that these are sort of advanced technologies of beings kind of like ourselves coming from other star systems and visiting us. Again, I mean, now, based on our current knowledge of physics, it's not clear how travel like that would work. But I also think it's possible there's some fundamental things we don't understand yet that we'll discover later. And so I think that we should just sort of be open to evidence, but that we should also be discerning. And so it's even if, I mean, Hank, I'll tell you, this is kind of where I am at the moment. I have talked to people that have had alien abduction experiences. That is, at least they explain it. What they believe happened is that these aliens abducted them and conducted experiments on them and then put them back in their beds or something like this. And I've read a lot about this. This is a very widely attested experience of people having an experience with other beings that can be quite negative. But if you think about it, okay, that way of describing these encounters is an artifact of the 20th century when we started having ideas about, spaceships and little green men and things like that. But that might simply be an interpretive grid of a spiritual encounter that people have been having since time immemorial. And I can tell you one woman I talked to at a conference, I was absolutely convinced she believed she had been abducted. I wasn't going to talk her out of it being aliens from another planet, but I had a very strong feeling that what she had encountered was hostile spiritual forces, which she was interpreting in this particular way. And so I have a feeling that a lot of these reports actually have something to do with that. And because we have so stripped our cosmology and our understanding of reality, so that maybe people have the idea that there's a God, but we forget that there can also be the Bible talks about all sorts of other spiritual beings that are part of God's created order, some of which are good and some of which are bad. And it's like that category has dropped out. And the only thing we have now is aliens on spaceships to account for these experiences. And I think, be open to the evidence for that one way or the other. I'm somewhat skeptical. But I think we also need to realize that actually Christians have metaphysical resources for explaining a lot of these experiences people have. And it may just be that in a materialistic age, people are having encounters with spiritual beings and they're interpreting them best they can as aliens from another planet.
What do you make of the hype in recent years about UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena? Sort of related.
Well, and so there's some of these cool video footage that the Navy has released of weird things on radars. And I'm sure a lot of folks listening have seen these videos. Now, of course, if they're aliens in spacecraft, that would be easy to confirm. I mean, it's like Independence Day. If we get a spaceship right overhead here, we're going to know, okay, there's aliens. But it's always these kind of distant things that are open to multiple interpretations. And so there are definitely some weird things happening, but it's not at all dispositive. It's not nowhere near strong enough, I think, to persuade skeptics. And at this point, I think I'm just skeptical enough of the government that when they start releasing this stuff, I'm thinking, what are they trying to distract us from? It's like, what are they doing? And they want us to start thinking about aliens. And so, again, it's always just like kind of right on the edge. And so at least at the moment, we've not gotten any evidence that I think would persuade a skeptic, nor should it. So I just really do think that this stuff's just still an open question.
So a lot of people are taking your book, The Privileged Planet, and saying this book is a science stopper. Your response?
Well, it's weird to argue that a book that argues that science itself is built into things, that not just life, but scientific discovery is built into the structure of the universe. How exactly that is a science stopper or anti-science is a mystery to me, because we're arguing that science has an intrinsic dignity and value in the scheme of things, but science ought to be about viewing and analyzing and discovering the universe as it is and following the evidence where it leads, not assuming ahead of time that the universe can't point beyond itself. And I think when people think, okay, well, anyone that argues that the universe had purpose, if they're saying that's anti-science, it's because they have confused science and its right definition with scientific materialism. But those are two different things.
We talked a little earlier about reading, cultivating the art and science of reading, the habit of reading. You talk about cultivating the skill of reading the book of nature. And that's really a big part of what you're talking about when you talk about The Privileged Planet. You're talking about the awe and the integrity that comes from learning or cultivating the habit of reading the book of nature.
That's right. And we talked about Psalm 19, the heavens declare of God, declare the glory of God. And of course, Paul in Romans 1, he says, from the foundation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen. That's a powerful claim. That's a strong claim that we can know clearly from the things God has made something about his nature and invisible qualities. Not just that, oh, the universe looks like it might be purposeful, but we actually can know something about God. And this traditional theological idea that just as there's a book of scripture, there's a book of nature. Press that metaphor a little bit. Well, what is a book? Well, if you open a book, if you know how to read a book, you don't attend to the text. It's like if you're focusing on the font size or the color of the ink, you're almost certainly not attending to the meaning of the text. If you're reading a book, those symbols become the means by which you read through the text to the meaning of its author, so that the intentions of the author are being transmitted to your mind by way of this physical object. That's what it means to read that kind of book. In the same way, if we press the metaphor, if the book of nature is a book, we have to learn how to read it. What are its symbols? What is the language in which it's written? But then if we genuinely learn to read it, we too should be able to read through it to the intentions of its author, so that the world is not just something, the kind of playpen that God has created for us to live. It's actually it's his general revelation of himself, and he leaves it to us to learn, to follow the clues, and to learn how to read it. But if we read it properly, we will read through it, and we will see that it points beyond itself to him.
As we bring the podcast to a close, I want to read something from your book and then ask you to comment on it. And this is a step in opening one's mind to an almost forgotten possibility. But this is what you write. Thus does our inquiry reduce to a single question. Could this immense symphonic system of atoms, fields, forces, stars, galaxies, people, and a planet called Earth have sprung not from some inscrutable outworking of blind necessity or an inexplicable accident, but instead from a choice and a purpose? And if so, then surely there could be evidence to suggest as much.
Absolutely. That is our conclusion, is our plea for people. Not that we don't want to bowl people over, but if we're genuinely interested in the question of whether there's purpose to the universe, if there's a God, the question isn't, okay, well, God needs to prove it to me. The proper approach should be, how do I dispose myself and open myself so that if there is a God and there is a purpose to the world, I will be able to see it? That's, I think, the true mark of wisdom in the 21st century.
Do you anticipate any future, and I'm talking about this in a specific sense, any future discoveries in astronomy that might significantly support your hypothesis of the privileged planet?
Yeah, I mean, the next generation of telescopes, we hope, will help us, enable us to be able to detect Earth-sized planets. We're not quite there yet. Guillermo's actually working in industry, actually, in that area now. We're not there yet, but I mean, that's going to bear very directly on our argument. We'll detect probably tens of thousands of extrasolar planets, and we hope eventually Earth-sized planets. And so that's gonna kind of narrow the field and winnow the possibilities. And so we hope maybe in 10 years or 15 years, we'll be able to give some really specific numbers to these things, where at the moment it's just kind of wide error bars on both sides.
I want you to help me to do something as we close the podcast, and that is convince people to get a copy of the book and maybe some advice on how to use the book. I mean, a lot of people look at a book this big and say, this is beyond my ability. You know, I may have said this many years ago, but this book is actually enjoyable to read. Talk about how you can best facilitate using this book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it is a good book often for book clubs in which you take a chapter a week or a month for a lot of people. Of course, lots of science people have no problem with it. But you can also watch the documentary back in 2004. I mean, we look a lot younger. You can find it actually free online. I think it's also on Netflix and Amazon, which is a 59-minute summary of the argument. But honestly, anyone that's listened to our conversation is going to get the gist of the book. But the book itself is where the details are. If people wonder why it's expensive or why it's so thick, in part, it's because it's packed with illustrations and figures. And there are also 20 pages of color plates in it. But we wanted there to be, you know, it to be one place where all of these arguments could be found. And we're just really thankful for the publisher to allow us to do that, because, it's hard these days to persuade a publisher to put lots of illustrations, especially color illustrations, in a book. But we're really pleased with the way it turned out.
Again, it is a fantastic book. It's the 20th anniversary edition of The Privileged Planet: How Our Place in the Cosmos is Designed for Discovery. And it is available for all of those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy on the web at equip.org, EQUIP.org, or you can write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Again, when you listen to the podcast, you are going to be blessed in so many ways, because the people that I interview are interesting, informative, and inspirational, and you're the quintessential example of that, Jay. I so appreciate you. Thanks so much for the contributions you're making. Your life is making a difference for not only time, but for eternity.
Thanks so much, Hank. So good to be with you.
Yeah, it was great to be with you as well. And if you enjoy the podcast, subscribe, rate, review. It helps a lot. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Look forward to seeing you next time with more.